Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Catherine London, primary care physician out of Maine, who has experienced, you could say, unique interactions with both the Maine State Licensing Board as well as the DEA, and has channeled those adversarial experiences into subject matter expertise for opioid policy. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. London. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So Dr. London, for the listening audience who may not be familiar with your work, can you begin by telling your story and how you became this leader in the opioid policy?
So I moved to Maine in 2015. And prior to that time, I was in New York City. I was an assistant professor at Cornell in New York City, and I had been there for 5 years. And before that, I was in Massachusetts in the Boston area. I had my own practice, but I also taught for both BU and Tufts. I'd lived there out of residency, so I was there for about 13 years. So I'd been in the academic world for a long time. My kids were getting older, and as the older one was heading off to college, I had moved to New York for the kids, and they really wanted to be near extended family. And so when I decided to move to Maine, it was really to, and I'd done a lot of work in the access to primary care for patients, you know, with our national groups and lobbying in both Washington and on the state level. So I had a real need to want to serve underserved populations. So I did a lot of soul searching, and I wanted to go to a rural underserved area, and ended up in a part of Maine called Washington County, which is on the coast near Canada. It's where lobsters and blueberries come from. It's really quite beautiful. And it was actually one of the areas targeted along with the Appalachian area when people talk about prescription opioid abuse. So, you know, when people want to go attacking the Sacklers and everything else, it was the other area that was very highly targeted, which I didn't know. I had no idea prior to moving. You know, I saw it as an area that was vastly underserved and decided to make the move, which, you know, my family was up in arms, like, you're this academic, blah, 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 what are you doing? You know? So I did. So, and I very quickly saw how hard hit the area was. There was a lot of substance use disorder. There was a call for more people to get their buprenorphine waivers or Suboxone waivers. And so I did. You know, it was also, we had not expanded Medicaid. I made a move to try to do that, which the governor at the time was not politically on that side. I butted heads there. So that may have been one of the reasons I came under targeting. I don't know, but it might be. I was at a federally qualified health center, and they kind of sat on my waiver. Even all, you know, I designed the program and, you know, for us to start treating substance use disorder, we had psychiatrists on site and everything else. And the board of the FQHC had approved it, and they kept sitting on it. And so 4 months of working there, it was enough. And we mutually separated, and I immediately started my own practice, where I started out literally going door to door. I didn't have office space yet, and treating people right out of their homes, and started using my waiver. Because the need was just that intense. Hit my 30 cap immediately, because the first year that you're prescribing, you can only treat 30 patients.
This is the X waiver you're referring to.
My X waiver, exactly. And I had met a retired cardiothoracic surgeon at the health center, and he and I had spoken about working together. He wanted to start a wound clinic, which was also vastly necessary in the region. So I was looking for office space. He had meantime gone back down to Southern Maine, and we stayed in touch. And he came up one day and accompanied me going door to door, and saw the tremendous need. And he said, you know, I'll get my X waiver if you run the program. And since I'd already designed it, I was like, fine, awesome. Cause that would give us another 30 slots.
Certainly.
So I encouraged him to do this and he took, you know, the exam and we were waiting for his waiver to come through. And I had to go down to New York to close on my apartment. I was selling my apartment. And so this is now 2016. And he was covering the practice while I was down. So he couldn't do any of the buprenorphine prescriptions, but he could do all the other controlled substances. And he's an older gentleman and he was, I would call it reckless in his prescribing. And we had an altercation on the phone, a real disagreement. And that was the end of our working relationship. He went his way and I went mine. And that was fine. Except he decided to start his own practice. Good for mm-hmm. him, right? Except he was telling people that we were still working together. And I started to get my own reputation in terms of, I'd meanwhile found office space. I'd started a real program and, you know, where I did real groups and people got to know that I was pretty strict and I, you know, and everything else. And I, unbeknownst to me, he was doing this. And word started to get back to me that he was kind of this Dr. Candyman.
You're right.
Like really irresponsibly. And then things would happen, like a patient would no-show. And I'd be checking the our prescription monitoring program and see that they would see him, you know, as I'd be checking for their visit. And he was doing some dangerous combinations and increasing meds and things that scared me, frankly. You know, where I was really worried that something dangerous was going to occur. And a lot of people came to me and said, can't you do anything? Can't you do anything? And innocently, you know, I said, you know, so I called SAMHSA to see if they could pull his waiver. They told me to call the DEA. I called the DEA and who first said, oh, have patients call, blah, blah, blah. And eventually they told me, call the board because the board can run a PMP check on him. And so I did, not thinking twice. The only experience I'd ever had with a medical board was back, you know, pre-2010 when I lived in Massachusetts. I had been a monitor for another physician who needed a practice monitor. So mm-hmm. it didn't occur to me that there would be anything but, you know, a positive experience. So I called the board and I told them my concerns and I was turned around and threatened that if I didn't put a complaint in, that the law was that I had to put a complaint in if I knew anything,
wow.
you know, per, you know, X and Y Z statute. So I took what I knew and I wrote it up and submitted it. Well, he turned around and meanwhile, okay. So he turned around and wrote a counter complaint claiming that I was crazy, that I yelled and screamed and got patients who I had stopped prescribing controlled substances for because they had violated their narcotics contract to say the same thing.
Wow.
And if you looked, it was so obvious, like they, all their stories were exactly the same.
Yeah.
It was so clearly collusion and retribution, but the board came after me. And meanwhile, one of his patients did die, but nothing ever happened to him. And the board came after me with a vengeance. I mean, a vengeance. It was outrageous. At first, you know, and it didn't occur to me to get a lawyer because I had done nothing wrong, right? They wanted records. Sure, here, have them. You know, like, it's just like I was naive and stupid. And after a year and a half or 2 years of their coming after me, I finally, we were headed towards an adjudicatory hearing and I was talked into by my attorneys who felt that I was not going to have a fair hearing. And they were worried that my license would be suspended. And that would obviously affect my practice and my patients. I signed a consent decree, which I made it through, where I, for a while, had to have a monitor for my controlled substances, you know, and hand in, you know, charts for, you know, this went on for 6 months to a year, whatever it was. They looked over my charts and they wanted me basically to taper everybody, all my chronic opioid patients, which was indiscriminate, arbitrary, capricious,
yeah.
horrible. It was, you know, let's torture patients, you know, it was, it was not a positive experience by any means. And then I had to go take coursework and other nonsense. They did send the DEA my way. I survived that because the coursework was actually funny. One of them was in charting, and you send your records ahead of time in there, and I get like all, oh, your records are great. Yeah. So it was actually funny. You know, it was like one of those, like, I knew this, you know, it was, so I went through it all, but not before they had raked my reputation through the holes. And of course you're in the database, and I got reflexive action. I hadn't held a Massachusetts license since 2011, but they basically took away my inchoate right to renew. New York, where I held a license, the only reason I kept my New York license was because I've always worked the marathon. Right. I first did Boston when I lived there. And when I moved to New York, I captained one of the tents at the finish line. And I promised the medical director I would continue to do that. But in New York, you have to maintain your license to do that. And I was going to let it go and not continue. They forced me to continue to stay licensed in New York, but there was no way for me to get, they made me also sign a consent decree, and I would be on probation until I came back to New York and did like something. And it's like, but I'm not coming back to New York, you know? And so there's like no way out. And yeah. I finally this year just told them I'm not renewing, and they called me up, and you know, and when I finished the main probation, they just were like, well, that's nice. And they still wouldn't do anything. And I just, so I finally, they were kind of rude and obnoxious. And I just finally said, well, I'm not renewing, you know, so do whatever you need to do to me. And I haven't heard anything yet. So
it's interesting,
but I'll happily litigate it at this point. Yeah.
It's interesting how physicians in your situation find themselves kind of experiencing the same templated format, where there's these cookie cutter complaints, the same kind of generic action by the state medical licensing board, which is really administered by the attorneys, not so much the physicians who are on the medical licensing board. And then you kind of go through this rigmarole of having your reputation destroyed and essentially having to go through the ringer and being flogged in public. Where did you develop the strength to kind of overcome this and then actually start to decide to go to law school?
Well, it was so clear that there was no due process involved. Like the whole process that I went through, there was clearly no fairness. That this other guy who had done something wrong, where a patient did die, there was harm. And nothing ever happened. Like, I'm like, are you kidding? And that it was, you know, you can go read through my consent decree. It's up on, you know, even though I'm through it, it's still up on the website, however long you're going to keep it there. And it's obvious to anyone who reads it, like what went down. And yet, so the the bias is clear and everything else. And I'm like, this is atrocious.
Yeah.
And then I start reading more cases and hearing more stories. And the more people I talk to, and I'm like, this is horrible. That's when I decided that, you know, I've been so into helping patients and watching medicine be ruined, that it's time for me to start helping protect physicians. You know, I graduated, you know, Yale Medical School in 1995, and it's time to change my focus. And so I'm still practicing. I've been practicing through law school. And when the real kicker was, I was already in law school when the DEA came to my office. And when they handed me a subpoena for medical records, I'm like, that's a Fourth Amendment violation, that they can sit there and ask for medical records based on an administrative subpoena. There's nobody, you know, I look at it as a privilege that patients tell me things. You know, it's an honor and a privilege that I sit down and I get people's stories, and that the government can just come in and demand that based on what? I was horrified. And that, because of that, I've now also completed Maine Law, is one of the few in the country that offers an additional certification in privacy law. And this paper that I just submit, you know, just wrote, was the last piece that I needed to complete that certification process. So I will also be getting that when I graduate.
Congratulations on that. Before we jump into your study, I want to talk a little bit about this concept of due process. As an attorney, due process is a very important concept in law that physicians don't get and allow their due process rights to be violated all the time. Talk to us about how due process is being violated among healthcare providers in the opioid epidemic and how that's being used to justify these unconstitutional investigations.
So the due process is a constitutional right, okay? It's in the Fifth and the 14th Amendments to the Constitution, and it prohibits the arbitrary deprivation of life, liberty, or property by the government. So your substantive rights. Yes. And
substantive due process rights.
Okay, and that's both in the Fifth and the 14th Amendment. So it falls to the states through the 14th Amendment. And so we have, our licenses are a property right, right? So you can't, it's a property right in the ability to practice, and amongst other things. So there's more than one way due process comes along. So to just come at us and not go through all the normal, so by depriving us the normal ways, when you think about like when someone's arrested, you're innocent till proven guilty. That's not the way it works in administrative law. And they don't follow the normal rules of evidence and all these other things. And it's just this, it's truly kangaroo court. You know, when you talk about like what kangaroo court is, administrative proceedings really are. And it's...
Is it willful? Is there a willful intent to take administrative actions and turn them criminal on the parts of the DEA and DOJ?
I'd say yes, because the DEA, their whole way that they work, they have no oversight because they're self-funded. That whole diversion task force is funded through licensing fees and through when they grab somebody. And so they never have to go to Congress.
Forfeitures.
When they get it through forfeitures, so they never have to go to Congress for money, so they through appropriations, so they don't come under any scrutiny. So it's a skirting of the law and a skirting of constitutional processes. And it's, you know, administrative law is huge. And I don't think people realize just how much of the law in this country, both on a federal and a state level, happens through administrative proceedings. But it's egregious the way it's happening in medicine. It's a whole other level. We are the most regulated industry, and it's our livelihoods, right? And
What's interesting
and it crosses over to that criminal piece, which is just horrifying.
What's interesting is alluding to the whole concept of administrative law is another concept that's very important, that of federalism. Did you ever experience the state licensing agency and state regulatory agencies almost work or collude with federal agencies in a way that would deprive you of your ability to defend yourself? And talk to us a little bit about that.
So they do work together, you know, and that there's nothing, unfortunately, illegal about that. So they'll turn around and hand stuff over. So, yeah, so you'll have the AAG who's working with the board turn around and hand stuff to the DEA or to the Department of Justice on the federal level. And that's not illegal. But it's like, where you turn around and you're like, and the only way to fight that then is to turn around and, you know, have a criminal attorney, then not have that evidence admitted, right? To turn around and do motions, one motion after another. And then, and you have to be savvy enough to do that, to say this is the fruit of the poisonous tree. And that this was not gotten in a way that is okay. And anything that the DEA has gotten that wasn't through normal channels also can't be used in a criminal proceeding. If they got it through their administrative proceedings, they can't use that criminally. That is not okay. But they do it all the time. Look how many times physicians, because all their assets were they have been seized. They're desperate. They're broke, and they turn around and they sign a plea agreement. You know, yeah. and there's countless cases of that. So it's just such a disservice to all of medicine.
But unlike so many of the physicians who have been targeted, you actually have decided to become an opioid leader in terms of policy and rectifying some of the wrongs. And as you alluded to in your study at the University of Maine School of Law, you are working on privacy studies. And one study in particular is, and I title it, Predicting Drug Diversion, the Use of Data Analytics in Prescription Drug Monitoring. Before we go into this, can you give a brief description of what this study is?
So I basically, you know, so my background before even medicine, I was a software engineer. So I wear my geek propeller very proudly. and so there's always been this kind of concept when you look at algorithms and you look at, and so this goes for, you know, all of math and all of like how, when you have computing going on and you know, now we're into this world of big data. You know, so we've got Google doing analytics on us and our shopping habits and everything else, right? And all the insurance companies are doing it. And everywhere you go, you know, you're being tracked, you know, get right. over it. And if you don't know that already, learn it. Well, it's a whole nother world when they are targeting the prescription data. And the prescription monitoring was touted as this tool to help physicians so that we would make sure that people aren't, you know, that we would be able to know if a patient is diverting. And so that we would, you know, help, you know, make sure that if someone isn't, you know, someone with substance use disorder. What a lot of crap. It's totally a law enforcement tool, and it's totally dressed up as, you know, being this clinical tool. And the biggest issue is that it's a black box algorithm. It's never been exposed to any outside verification, and it truly is garbage in, garbage out. The more that we've learned about it, the more that we have been able to get a glimpse of what kind of data mining is going on, the more problematic it is.
Well, let's talk about that, because you allude to it very eloquently when you talk about odds ratio. First, explain the concept of odds ratio for those who may not understand it, the listening audience, and then explain how you beautifully use the odds ratio to demonstrate bias in the model.
Okay, so let's start with that. The entire database was based on just Ohio and then generalized to the entire country. Now,
that's amazing.
We are not just Ohio. We're a big country. That is one of the issues that America, you know, why we can't generalize with what, you know, even any of the European countries do, is because we are so vast and so diverse. So, all right. So odds ratio, it's a measure of the association between an exposure and an outcome. It's the odds that an outcome is going to occur given a particular exposure compared to the odds that the outcome is going to occur in the absence of that exposure. Okay. It's the kind of a risk probability, the proportion of those who are exposed with this outcome compared to like the total population. Right. Sure. So if you have an odds ratio of 10.1, that's 1,010% increase in the odds of an outcome. It's not a multiplication of the likelihood. So it's a measure of the projected likelihood that something's going to occur.
Right.
But then you have to take that with it. Then you can then look at the confidence interval. Okay. So a confidence interval is the 95% probability that your true odds ratio, so your true chance that it's likely to occur between the upper and lower limits, assuming that you don't have bias or confounding in your data. All right, so there are general confidence intervals basically tell you how much random error you have in your data. And right. So the width of your confidence interval gives you that estimate. And that's where their algorithm falls apart. So if you take a look, you know, from, it starts out not too bad, you know, a little wider than I would like. So from 0 to 190, so they do these 3-digit scores. And so from 0 to 190, overdose risk score of 0 to 190, the odds ratio is 1.0 as a reference, except that the true odds ratio is 7.9 with a confidence interval that goes from 6.1 to 10.1. So we're already starting from, you know, okay. Now you go to 200 to 290, where they call it an odds ratio of 2. Well, the real one is 10.1 and your range is 7.8 to 13. And it just gets worse from there. We're at 700 to 790, where it's an odds, they call it an odds ratio of 38. It's really 76 with a confidence interval of 55 to 103 and so on. It's, these are huge. These are extremely large errors. And so as an example, you know, we graphed out, it's basically over-predicting the overdose risk.
And so for the listening audience, I just want to let you guys know that I will post a link to the study. So please go ahead and take a look at the study as we're talking.
And so then, so we just like, if you, I put the graph just highlighting the errors at 56, 60, and 125%. So it calculated 54 times the means, where if you're at 90 morphine equivalents, that really should be reflected as 4,500 morphine equivalents. Yeah. And so if we compare, you know, as a comparison, if we're talking 200,000 dead from COVID, would be 10 million dead.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. As a matter of fact, that is probably the most important part, at least for me, in my humble opinion, and is correlating the sources 41 and 42 in the write-up itself. You correlate error in the model with miscalculations on appropriate doses of certain opioids as calculated by millimorphine equivalents. And how many physicians throughout the country, providers, nurses, what have you, have been arrested, indicted, and convicted off of this faulty, erroneous algorithm? It's remarkable what you found. And as much as possible, can you simplify that correlation between the error rate and the true millimorphine equivalents for the audience? And I know it's not a simple thing to do.
Right. So 90 is the CDC has been caught, like in Maine, that's been codified as the cutoff.
Yeah.
Right. In 2016,
essentially becoming law.
Right. In 2016 became law. That's the cutoff. That's as much as we're allowed to do. And it's a huge red flag. To the exceptions that we have to go through and the hoops that I have to jump through to go above that are enormous. And you know, you get all this stuff, you know, about when you go above that, and you have to have an exception code, and this and that, and everything else, and you're flagged, as you know, the patient is, and so are you. So you know, and again, these, and so the NARC score then also of the patient will go up, right? Because they're higher. So that's another flag that's going to go up. And so it's identifying as high risk for opioid use disorder. So all these things are going to get flagged, but so it's you're going to now flag the providers, you're going to flag the prescribers, you're going to flag the patients. The models are trained on objectives that don't give you a proxy for what you're interested in, which is you're really supposed to be interested in who might have substance use disorder at an exposure, but that's not what you're getting to.
Exactly.
You're looking at, like, it's flagging chronic pain patients who have comorbidities as high risk. It's looking at things like, oh, you're rural, you've had trauma, you have multiple prescribers because you go to a university or you go to a clinic that has multiple people, you know, because now doctors are all employees, or you relocated because you got a job. And you pay cash because now it's always needing a prior authorization and you can't wait a week to get your pain meds. You know, so the algorithm is falsely seeing all those as doctor shopping and drug, and it means that you are either diverting or it's substance use.
That's really fascinating, and how the errors in the data lead to misconceptions that discriminate against certain patients and target certain providers. That is an incredibly, incredibly important finding. And thank you so much for what you discovered through your work. It's amazing. One of the solutions, or at least potential administrative remedy you allude to is going to the FDA and asking them to verify this. Talk a little bit about what the FDA's oversight should be and how they're falling short.
So yeah, so Professor Oliva, actually, of Seton Hall, is the one who I have to give her credit, because she is the one who pointed to this, and I picked up on her work from that. So it's basically, so if you look, the FDA has the, yes, they do oversight. And because this is a clinical support tool, right? And so it makes them subject to FDA regulation. And in this, FDA regulates medical devices, and software as a medical device is considered part of clinical decision support tools. So if you look at the Section 3060 of the 21st Century Cures Act, there are five exemptions to that, to this software as a medical device, which this does not meet, right? So for the FDA to validate this as a medical device, you need to have a clinical association between the software's output and its targeted clinical condition. So you have to show that the software is going to process input data to generate accurate, reliable output that achieves its intended purpose in the context of clinical care. But that's exactly what these don't do. The PDMPs right. are not reducing overdose deaths or improving patient outcomes. It would fail on safety and effectiveness criteria that the FDA puts out.
And that's really interesting, because it doesn't meet a clinical end, but it's certainly used for legal ends. And in a way, right. the data becomes the due process. So why is this rampant misuse of the data allowed to permeate so widely across the country?
Well, the FDA has not stepped in. And then again, if you look, they're housed in all different places. Some people house them, you know, some don't hide that it's a law enforcement tool. They have it housed. You know, if you look at the history, so you have to remember, so PDMPs, the reason they've been allowed, they started on paper, right? The mm-hmm. earliest ones were all the way back, you know, really, really, really early. And they got, 1918 was the first one. It was rescinded, but that was the earliest one. And then they started, and you know, they were 1939, 1943, but these were all those triplicate prescriptions we all used to write on back mm-hmm. in the day. And they were only for Schedule II drugs. And the Supreme Court and it's still good law, 1977, a case called Roe v. Whalen, that they were not unconstitutional, because they felt that they didn't, that it was part of the state police powers. Okay. Mm. And it was, but they were, again, they were based on paper, static, very limited information, you know, and it's, but then these rampant electronic ones with all this stuff, they haven't been challenged. And the FDA has not stepped in any way. But if you look at where they're housed in all different places. Some are in the Board of Pharmacy, some are in the Department of Health, some are in professional licensing, and five of them are actually in law enforcement.
Yeah, that's so, really,
you know, some are in substance abuse. So, you know, so we haven't even, this is that whole, we're a federalist republic. So where are they housed and who has access? You know, the DEA can't, DEA can directly get to it in some states and not in other states, but they get around that, and now they're creating their own database, and that's really frightening. You know, they still can get to it with an administrative subpoena pretty easily, so it's not like it's a hard bar for them to get to.
Well, let me ask you this, though.
Simple.
So for somebody who may not get this, when it's just simple, basic data, it's one thing. But when the data is aggregated, it becomes more complex. It becomes something different. How does that process take place? And how does the risk of abuse take place the more complex the data becomes?
So you have to understand that, like, so right now, when you look at what's in these things now, and then they're getting more and more and more. I mean, as it is, you're dealing with, it tracks all the information about the patient, all the information about the prescriber. We have to put a diagnosis. So that's already a huge violation right there, right? You know, it's Many of them are tracking marijuana now. In addition, many of them track methadone. Many of them are tracking, you know, so there's all these, many have data from child welfare cases, drug court, arrests and convictions, Narcan dispensing, you know, and if there's been any disciplinary actions on any registrant, if there's been lost or stolen drugs, you know, and then you have the insurance companies are getting access. Marijuana dispensaries are getting access, you know, and then all of us who get these, you know, these unsolicited report cards that compare you to prescribers, you know, in your state, you know, that's a chilling effect, you know. Really, you know, you see that you're, you know, higher than average, you're going to cut down on what you're doing because you know you're going to be targeted. It's just how we work, you know, how we're human beings. Now we know, and we know that APRIS has been looking to get an auto database, a real estate database. How is that going to, you know, we already know redlining happens. What's going to happen now? So the more data that goes in there, we know just on a retail level that those have been incredibly racist in how they've been done. What else is going to happen here? So I'm horrified by all of this. From a privacy point of view, this is really disturbing.
It certainly is. And I think the more input you have, the greater the likelihood of attribution error and the greater the likelihood of biases against disenfranchised individuals. So we have all this data. What do we do with it now? Can we help develop new opioid policies? Can we help rectify erroneous convictions? What do we do with this data?
Well, the first thing is that the algorithm needs sunlight. You know, it needs to be looked at by people outside of a priest. And this study that they supposedly just did, it wasn't. It was two states, and it was just a questionnaire. That is not studying the algorithm. Yeah. Oh my God, that is not validating your algorithm. Yeah, just shut up. So that needs to happen. We need to know exactly what variables are being looked at and everything else. So that's number one. I don't think the NARCS care score should be in there at all. I think that if you want to use a PDMP, let us all look at it and validate in our own way. Do not use a NARCS care score at all. That's number one. Because there's so many different reasons that people have to go to more than one pharmacy and everything else and all the other stuff that's just nonsense. And this idea of ranking, it needs to go away. Yeah. There's my opinion of the DEA should have just nothing to do with physicians. That's my personal opinion. We've done so much harm to pain patients and access to care there the irony is that the real pill mills, the few that there were shut down, you know, more than a decade ago. And the majority of black market prescription pills probably didn't come from doctor's prescription diverting. They came from theft from warehouses. So yeah. The irony is it was the DEA at fault the whole time. And they're just trying to point the finger elsewhere. And so we need the DEA looked at. And I want to see that congressional inquiry. I want the accountability elsewhere and let doctors do their jobs appropriately. And, you know, and I would like to see due process standards in place in how boards of medicine work. I'm not holding my breath on that one. The problem is it costs money and nobody wants to put the money there. Yeah. But you certainly, you know, the way it's working right now is horrendous. You know, the minimal I will tell people is, you know, the board is not your friend and do not respond on your own ever. Get a lawyer, you know. Lawyer up right away. Never do it on your own.
It's amazing how many physicians are unaware of that and simply walk into these processes with their eyes closed only to basically just line themselves up for the galley. It's amazing.
Because everybody thinks, I didn't do anything wrong, so I'm fine. And they think the people who get dinged did something wrong. And it's like, no. I mean, people know me from my work in the AAFP and everything else. They know I'm a straight shooter. I did nothing wrong. This was just, you know, I'm right now, like, there's a claim, an unadjudicated claim, that another doctor who admittedly screwed up claims that I yelled at her on the phone, and the board wants me to sign a consent decree over that.
Wow.
Even though I didn't, but they're just basically believing her story.
How things get so subjective in that manner, where when you don't have due process, there is this vast amount of subjectivity that comes into these disciplinary actions.
So I'm supposed to do a year of psychotherapy with monthly reporting to the board and 2 anger management classes. I'm like, go sit and pound sand. It's not going to happen.
Unbelievable. But let me ask you this now. So soon you will be both a physician and an attorney, even though in many ways you know more about administrative law than most people in this country, which is amazing in its own right. What role do the courts have at the federal and state level? What roles do the courts have to helping fix all of this mess that has led us into the opioid epidemic?
So it's going to be little by little. I mean, so I'm doing right now, I'm in our juvenile justice clinic, you know, because that's obviously a lot of kids, when kids get into trouble, number one, when a child ends up in the juvenile justice system, to me, it's a family we have failed. It's a child that we didn't identify. And substance use will often start at a young age, partly from what we start to do when we start to criminalize adolescents and adolescents acting out. And I think that's the place to start, by starting to have more community services. And that's where the changes have to start. We have to stop criminalizing a lot of this activity and go back to treating. And, you know, that whole harm reduction piece, that, you know, until we take that slant, in my opinion, we should legalize all drugs and tax us not out of it and have a safe supply. That's now, my opinion.
Can the courts adjudicate harm reduction as a form of interpretation law, essentially create case law where harm reduction is considered standard of care?
On some things, not on everything. Like, we have drug court, we have, you know, there's the ways to do diversion. So yes and no. So it depends. I'm going to give the lawyer answer of it depends. and there'll be times that, yeah, you can do treatment, you can do this, you can do that, so that you can keep someone from ending up in the system over and over and over again. But so much of it is can we start the prevention piece back? You know, this goes all the way back to Reagan when he closed appropriately the state hospitals. We didn't get enough community services all the way back then. And so we need to start implementing. We need so much more, like, just even looking at, like, when kids, first of all, we shouldn't have juvenile prisons. Let's start from there. You know, if you do need to deal with some sort of intensive treatment facility for a child, it shouldn't be a prison. And don't tell me they're not, these detention centers are, and they're horrid. So that needs to change right there. We need more community-based intensive kind of services. And we need to change that whole model. And then we need to have a way to transition them back into adulthood and into the community. And then we need to keep that model and raise it up, right? Because we all know brain development goes into the mid-20s, right? 25, 26, 27, until your brain is fully developed. So, and that's so much of the age when all this crap goes on. And a lot of the damage from opioid use disorder and other substance use disorder, we really need to wrap our heads around, what does that mean to do harm reduction? And that means we can't just have methadone be at a clinic that you go to, and that that is in some weird part of town that you can't get to, that is only open early in the morning. I have the fishermen in Washington County, they're on their boats at 3, 4, 5 in the morning. They can't do methadone, you know, that's absurd. The fact that this, you know, 50, 60 years later, that's how we're still doing it, is outrageous. And buprenorphine is not going to work for everybody. So you need to meet people where they're at. You know, what is it, Switzerland that does heroin, you know, as well as treatment, and people work. We need to get to a safe supply so people stop dying. Let's start from there. You know, 100,000 dead, like, let's, can we start from there? And again, I'd rather see a safe supply and tax us not out of it, so that we can just start working backwards from there. That's, you know, meet people where they're at.
In terms of positive changes, things that make you feel like we're moving in the right direction, namely the public nuisance ordinance in Oklahoma and California, or the Supreme Court reviewing the definition of good faith, do you see things moving in a right direction, or do you still see us going back and forth?
It's still a lot of back and forth. We're not there yet. There's not enough mobility in the right direction. I think there's more of an appetite in the public, but you still have like these pockets who, I mean, you have shows like Dope Sick, you know, and you kind of look and you kind of go, seriously, you know, they're doing that again, you know, that narrative is still out there, and the damage from prop, and, you know, and those people need to be held accountable. And I'm astounded, and the number of people who buy into that and hold on to that, it's reprehensible to me.
So would you say that this is a statutory play, that there needs to be legislation that makes harm reduction and incentivizes safe drug use practices?
I mean, yeah, it's going to be a rewrite of the Controlled Substance Act.
Yeah,
that has to happen, you know, and redefine the role of the DEA, or abolish it. It would be my opinion, but that's not going to happen tomorrow.
Well, I think, Dr. London, you're uniquely positioned because, one, you are a physician practicing in this space. Two, you are now well-versed in law, so to be a full attorney. But three, you also have experience in advocacy, lobbying, and public policy. So if you were to put your hat on and kind of imagine where you could allocate all your resources, as unrealistic as that may sound, allocate all your resources, where do you think the greatest benefit would lie? Would it lie in Congress, with the courts, or the state? Where would you invest your time and effort?
So I would ask Congress to either totally revisit the Controlled Substance Act, and consider, and the DEA needs to, their role needs to change. It needs to just be focused on trafficking of illicit substances, period. And the movement of licit needs to just be under the FDA. I think the DEA has done a piss poor job on the rest, and it's done too much damage, is what it shows me. That there's been a trajectory since the 70s, straight up, in terms of that's all we've seen. You can see the trajectory from the enactment of the CSA to today in terms of overdose, and that to me says that this is a failed experiment. And if so, that to me says that we need legislation. This needs a legislative fix to, as a beginning point. And that's a whole lot of money that could then be spent elsewhere. If you take that money that is right now being spent, the trillions that go towards the DEA, and instead invest that in community resources, that would be huge. That would be huge. And that's what I would like to see.
Certainly. And Dr. Lynn, I want to thank you so much for your time and your insight. Your paper has done wonders at really delineating in clear terms the impact that these metrics have had on enforcing not clinical outcomes, but legal violations of due process. And I think that that's a very important step to getting things right, increasing transparency. For the audience, can you, I guess, leave us with maybe a more personal commentary on a time when you were most down, when you felt most overwhelmed? Where did you develop the strength to move forward? And did you envision yourself in those most low moments being as productive and as effective as an advocate as you are now?
Oh no. When I signed that consent decree, I mean, I was definitely passively suicidal. I'm not gonna, lie. It was bad. To the point where, I mean, I'm down in Portland right now because of school, but my home is in Millbridge, Maine, in the woods. when you live in the woods and there's other critters that attack your dogs and the rest of it, you are a gun owner. I had to lock my guns away. That was just, I was that low. I have kids, so they were like, no, we still need you, mom. They're grown now. So they were like, we still need you, mom. there's a deep resilience. I come from tough stock. I have a great family. I really do. My family of origin, we have our ups and downs, but we're there for each other in the end. And that helped. The patient, my patients didn't leave me, despite all mm-hmm. this bull. There are the people who are, there are the people who are going to talk crap about you everywhere, and the haters are going to hate, but I don't have to answer to them. I have to remember that I'm not here for them. I'm here to do what I think is right and follow that path. And I know what I've done right and wrong. I know in my heart what is right and wrong. I know if I've done the right thing or the wrong thing, and I just keep moving forward. And that's all I can do. And so now, when I take a client to court, or I help a patient, those are the wins, right? Those are the wins. And the rest of it is just chatter. COVID's brought out a lot of it. A lot of people have seen the kind of, all of us have had to deal with kind of the nonsense that I've had to be dealing a lot with. And it's just like, I don't even let it come in anymore. And there's a lot of work to do and a lot of rights to be wronged. And I see when I see colleagues being sent to prison and I know they shouldn't be, that has to change.
Well, certainly. Thank you so much for that open reflection, Dr. London. Your work is inspiring, and I would encourage everybody listening to this podcast to please take a look at that research paper and digest through all the information. It is worth the time reading. So thank you so much, Dr. London.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.